Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media Network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I've written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture. And joining me today is, of course, my co-host, Liz.
Hi, everyone. I'm Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a graduate student of English at BYU, and a Latter-day Saint.
And we have two guests today. I'm excited to bring Megan onto the podcast. Megan, could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm a teacher and a Sunday school teacher, and I'm a Mormon culture and pop culture super fan. My brain loves where the two things intersect.
Well, this is the podcast for you. And joining us also is Matthew Bowman. Matt, could you introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Matt Bowman. I am a professor of religious studies. I was also briefly for 2 years a film major before I decided that a film major was a bad move career-wise, and so became a history major instead.
We're excited to have you both join us here today, where we're going to be talking about Indiana Jones. We'll be mostly focusing on the latest film, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, which is now available to stream on Disney Plus, but we're also going to talk about the Indiana Jones mythos generally and some possible fun connections to the Latter-day Saints. But first, we're going to do our Best Books segment, where we each recommend one thing we are watching, reading, or listening to. I have one and a half recommendations today. The first is a book, A Memory Called Empire. It won the Hugo Award in 2020, and it was just really a fun reads. There's good science fiction there about the nature of memory and the nature of what makes an individual up. Because one of the conceits is you can put a little implant in your head that has like the memories of previous people. So like if you want to be a pilot, you can have like 14 generations of pilots in your head with you, helping you be a better pilot. But what does that do to your identity? And anyway, there are just some good science fiction conversations in this book as all the shenanigans happen with assassinations of ambassadors and alien wars and fun stuff like that. And so I really enjoyed A Memory Called Empire, and I'm happy to recommend that to you guys. I do have another recommendation, but I'm not going to say it out loud. So if you want a recommendation for a very R-rated anime that is amazing in every way, but I don't feel comfortable recommending it on a Latter-day Saint podcast, send me a DM. But I've got one that just blew me away, but you have to send me a note if you'd like to figure out what that is. So anyway, Liz, what do you got for us this time?
Well, I'll give our non-R-rated anime recommendation for today. My husband and I have been watching this anime on Netflix called Delicious in Dungeon, and it's a faux Dungeons & Dragons feel, but basically this group of adventurers, they're really poor, they can't afford the supplies they need to go back into the dungeon, and so they decide they're going to live off the dungeon by cooking the monsters and harvesting them and cooking them into all sorts of dishes. So it's like a combination of Dungeons and Dragons anime with a whole bunch of anime food porn, just like the beautifully illustrated food that just makes you want to go out to a Japanese restaurant like now. So it's really fun, very light, very enjoyable. It's still coming out. So no content warnings right now. And that's called Delicious in Dungeon.
So I really wanted to find a cool recommendation, but I think I'll just be honest. There is a show called Strange-est Things where museums around the world pick two or three of their strangest things. And it's really harkens back to the 90s kind of History Channel. There's very short segments. They go about three or four things per episode. There's lots of green screen involved, lots of talking head. But I find it so fascinating and so fun to watch. I just have to recommend it. I think you can see season 2 on HBO. I think you could probably purchase it. But it just gives you those little tidbits. It really took me back to my childhood watching History Channel to learn about interesting things presented in a really delightful way. It's really delightful. Particularly, there is this episode about the mirror of Dr. John Dee. You guys familiar with Dr. John Dee?
Absolutely.
So Dr. John Dee was the official astrologer of Elizabeth I.
Just say wizard. He was a wizard.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's what they called him. He was the wizard of Elizabeth I. In fact, she was coronated on January 15th. Usually it was on like a special saint's day, but because he had like studied the stars and the heavens. He famously said he had a Urim and Thummim and that he could use it to translate things and see angels. So there's a really good intersection here. He's a very fascinating person. But they had one of his black mirrors, and it was just in a museum. And finally, somebody said, what do you think it's made of? And so they did a geochemical analysis of this mirror that Dr. D had that he said he used to predict the future, a scrying mirror. He used to see angels and make good decisions for the kingdom. And it's from Mexico. It's made of obsidian. And so to understand, like in the mine in Europe, how you could have this artifact that they probably took during one of the campaigns that had just happened and brought it over to England so that they could use it, this idea of the old world and the new world joining. I just find that so fascinating. Really good. Just like Indiana Jones.
I was going to say, this sounds like an excellent accompaniment to Indiana Jones.
Latter-day Saints and Indiana Jones, the old world, the new world, the Book of Mormon, Mesoamerica. We're checking all the boxes at once. All right. Thanks for that recommendation. Matt, what do you have for our listeners this episode?
So I couldn't decide. So I have three things. One reading, one TV, one movie. This is the time of year when I, as a forlorn, lost film major, find it very important to watch all of the major Oscar movies. So I would recommend Past Lives, which is a small film by Celine Song that's nominated for Best Picture and Best Screenplay. It is absolutely heartbreaking about a Korean woman who migrates to the United States while she is in high school, meets an American man and falls in love with him. And then her childhood best friend, quasi-boyfriend from when she was 13, shows up again in her life. And it is moving and touching and deeply profound. On the opposite end of the spectrum, my wife and I are right now watching Cunt on Earth on Netflix, which is a British comedy series in the best tradition, I think, of very classic 70s and 80s British comedy like Fawlty Towers, entirely straight-faced, but utterly ridiculous, full of delightful introductions to world history. So that is recommended. Finally, I am a deep fan of classic detective novels, and I am reading right now Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, which has been made into a film a couple of times, most notably by Alfred Hitchcock. It is gothic and soapy, and the kind of best combination. You just think of a wonderful combination of The Great Gatsby and the work of the Bronte sisters, and that will about nail it. There are ghosts, and there are decaying mansions, and there are crazy, insane, elderly British ladies, and all the best kind of stuff you would hope for. So, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Thank you for those recommendations. We will have links to all of these on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through those links helps support our podcast so that we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and beautiful in pop culture. And now on to our main discussion of Indiana Jones. We wanted to start with the original post that ended up being the catalyst for an article that... Anyway, Megan, I'm just going to toss it to you and say, go ahead and get us started. You're the one who was the genesis in some ways for all of this, so take it away.
Well, imagine, if you will, a little 8 or 9-year-old girl who loves Sunday school and loves history and watches the History Channel for fun and reads history books for fun and doesn't seem to see any conflict at all with her religious beliefs and the scientific beliefs around her. And then one day she's watching a show that comes on TV and she sees someone who she really relates to, someone who studies and loves history so much. And she thinks to herself, when she grows up, she's going to enter that extremely lucrative field of academic archaeology and become just like this person. And as she grows, she learns more and she can see that he's just like her. And then one day she watches The Last Crusade, and at a pivotal moment early on, it's revealed that main character is not only a Boy Scout in about 1912, but also in bold letters across the screen says he's from Utah. Now, I was this little girl, and I had never lived in Utah, but I understood Utah to always be a shorthand for the LDS experience, for LDS culture. If you were trying to express without saying it out loud that something was from Mormon history, you would say this person was from Utah. or this particular document is from Utah, and to have it so boldly written solidified it for me. I knew that this person was definitely as Mormon as I was. A representation for this time period in Mormonism is really rare. It seems as though when we study Mormonism, we start with Doctrine and Covenants, and it fizzles out. The way we study in Sunday school almost stops in the 1850s with maybe a declaration here or there. But I always found it so interesting, that time in between the Utah period until about the 1960s or 70s, because that's when I felt like the culture really happened, when what I saw, the way Sunday school worked, the way church worked, the way the church government worked, really came from that time period. And in Indiana Jones, I found that representation. So fast forward, I am a mom, my husband is deployed, I am doing my annual activity where I watch Indiana Jones for Easter, and I just shoot off what I thought was obvious to everyone, this post where I say, and I thought it was obvious, I always watch Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I would like to remind you all that Indiana Jones is definitely Mormon. Probably Jack Mormon, but definitely Mormon. And then I go on to list these various reasons why I believe this. He's a Boy Scout in Utah in 1912. That means he was probably born in Utah in the 1890s. His father is a European immigrant from the British Isles. So that means he might have immigrated even as early as the 1870s or possibly earlier, depending on how old he was when he immigrated. He has this very deep religious interest. He loves languages and translations and records and artifacts, and that he also went to Harvard and became a scholar there. I was familiar with the fact that many of the children of the pioneers went back east and received very prestigious educations in that Utah period. And I just felt like it was very representative of the era. And when I wrote that down, I didn't think it would have the mass appeal. Immediately, I began to get comments and comments. People had never thought of it before, apparently. This thing that had been so obvious to me had never struck people. And maybe it's because we don't think of the Utah period that way. But also, I know that I don't think that it was Mr. Spielberg's intent that Indiana Jones be Mormon. And I understood that. But I want to thank Lucasfilm and Mr. Spielberg for creating such an important and pretty accurate representation for me as a child of what an LDS person might be like in a heightened fantasy world in the early 1900s. I really appreciate, for me, in a lot of ways, it's more the most accurate Mormon representation I've seen in film.
Well, there you go, everybody.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
Megan's headcanon is that Indiana Jones is a lapsed Latter-day Saint. So there you have it. And of course, it was the early 1900s, so we could use the term Mormon for historical accuracy's sake then. But here we are. Indiana Jones is Mormon. Who knew? And then Matt took that and turned that into a BCC post. And so, Matt, why don't you give sort of your thoughts on Megan's headcanon that actually I think I'm going to adopt myself, just to be clear.
It blew my mind when I saw this, and I was really mostly angry with myself that I had never noticed this. When I grew up, we had a VCR and about six VHS tapes, and one of them was a recording of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade done from television. So we lost the first about 4 minutes, and maybe that's why I didn't see it, because it didn't say Utah on it. But it was labeled Indiana Jones's and the Last Crusade, which I wrote when I was 6 years old. But I had seen this movie probably 25 times. And when Megan wrote this, I thought, wow, it's absolutely correct, because it hit so many of the significant important points about what was Mormon culture in the late 19th and early 20th century. As Megan said, right, this is a period of increased integration among the Latter-day Saints. Many of them are going east for academic education. And also, one thing she did not mention is this is the time period in which not just LDS folks, but people in the Western world generally, the Protestants of all sorts, are becoming fascinated with archaeology. The idea that we can prove the veracity of the Bible by digging stuff up is really taking hold in Britain and in Germany. There are massive European trips to the Holy Land to do this sort of digging. And of course, LDS people are doing this too with the Book of Mormon. Benjamin Clough, who was president of BYU in the 1890s, actually abandons his job and leads a bunch of BYU students and faculty on a quest to Central America to dig up Nephites, and they walk from Utah down to Central America and back. It takes 2 years. Many of them actually don't make it. That they wholeheartedly believe that they could do this, I think, proves how what the hold of archaeology on Warren Mind was at this point. And so, of course, Dr. Jones and his son fit right into this. So yes, I read Megan's post. I thought it was amazing. She and I edited it together, turned it into a full-scale blog post, put it on By Common Consent, where it is currently the second most read post on By Common Consent of all time, behind only a post called Mormons Name Their Kids the Darndest Things 2016.
And we will have that link in the show notes for those of you who have not read that post, which is amazing and wonderful and find interesting. I have to admit, when I saw that Indiana Jones was doing Boy Scout stuff in 1912, I just assumed Boy Scouts just did more awesome stuff in the 1900s, where you would go from Southern California and then go on a donkey hike outing thing for days and days or weeks in Southern Utah or Northern Arizona or whatever else. And it never occurred to me that he was Latter-day Saint. And I think you're right, Megan. I don't think Spielberg intended it for it to be that way. I don't think he knows that much about early Latter-day Saint culture in the early 20th century, late 19th century, but he absolutely nailed it. So yeah, headcanon.
The reason that I really like this theory is because it fits so well with what was going on with Mormon culture in the period. You already talked about like the desire to prove scripture with archaeology, but I think there's also this kind of schism in the Mormon brain, right, of these people who go back and get an education back east and are exposed to more high culture, coming back and then having a disconnect with their LDS culture and figuring out how to reconcile those two together. I'm thinking of Eugene England called the Mormon literature of this period the lost generation, right, because they're the people who went back east and then had mixed feelings about the Utah culture they grew up in. They tried to represent it positively, but everyone back in Utah read it as a criticism of their culture, and they just didn't know what to do. And I see that same kind of impulse in the Indiana Jones movies, where he like wants to believe in things and sometimes manages it, but then he also like is skeptical about it. And so he lives in this like liminal gray space between things. It reminds me of like how we are today. I think we're in the same kind of period. Stephen Carter brought this up in his book that he wrote about Virginia Sorensen, who was an author during this period, of how a lot of the books written back then read so contemporary right now. Many of the issues and things people are struggling with faith and knowledge and modern culture and then LDS culture, those issues are coming around again, and so it feels so contemporary as well.
We can call it Indiana Jones and the Problem of Theism. Yeah, I think it's a really good point, right? You do see this in a lot of these kind of people, right? They go back east, they get all fancified and educated, and then they start to feel, some of them, vaguely embarrassed of what they see as the sort of parochialness of LDS culture, right? And then there's this big effort to build connections, right? And to show, you know, this thing that we do in Utah, it actually mirrors this big important thing that they're doing at Harvard and that kind of thing. Another, and I'm just going to keep doing this, so forgive me. We could also call this Indiana Jones and the Invention of World Religions, which is a phrase that occurred to me here, right? This is a period, right, when you have a lot of Americans and Europeans are, this is the era of colonialism, right? They're going to Africa, they're going to India, the British are taking over India. There are British and American missionaries setting up hospitals and schools and all sorts of things in Africa, in Latin America, and they're grappling with all of these other religions around the world, right? And you see this with Indiana Jones. The one kind of fascinating outlier in the first trilogy is the Temple of Doom, which isn't about the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament in any sense, right? It's very much this sort of weird, and it's the weird one in the end, and the first trilogy, right? It's always thought of that way. And I think because of this, it appears from this movie that the deities of Hinduism are actually real. And so we're living in a world in which the deities of Hinduism are real, but the Ark of the Covenant also works. And it appears that the Holy Grail is real too. And so Indiana Jones is undergoing this same kind of complicated grapple with the concept of religion, right? What is religion? What makes something real or not real? As so many other Europeans are, when they go to India and they discover, wow, these people have this whole cosmology and worldview that has nothing to do with Christianity. And so they try to explain it. And many of them come to this kind of like odd, benevolent pluralism that Indiana Jones himself embraced, which says there are good things about all of these religions. There's truth everywhere. And this is the kind of sort of soft pluralism you get by the late 20th century, right? It says all religions are basically the same. They all have truth in their own ways, too. And Indiana Jones, right, his kind of ambivalence, his inability to say, I'm a devout Christian, or I believe in Judaism because I saw the Ark of the Covenant, is really characteristic of this willingness to live in tension and to say, all things are true, some of everything is true, I'm not going to choose.
Though I want to say, I don't know that if my experience were that of the Temple of Doom, that I would think that those deities are necessarily benevolent. Their priests are like ripping hearts out of people and stuff.
Well, doesn't Christian theology also have unbenevolent spirits or people who misuse religion?
Yeah. Well, then this is where so many of these Americans and British people who are doing this are like really super educated Protestants. And you see this in some of the disaffected Mormons of this period, right? Who get embarrassed by the ways in which Mormonism is not Protestant, right? Because they're thinking of like good religion, real religion is about basically like being a nice person to people and praying in private. Good religion is not about like putting on weird costumes and ripping people's hearts out and waving artifacts around and stuff like that. The way that Hinduism is presented in the Temple of Doom is very characteristic of European culture in the early 20th century, which is to say all of these rituals, all this chanting, all of these people prancing around and drinking weird stuff and all of that, that's all primitive. And that, I think, throughout the first three movies in particular, right? All of these artifacts, these rituals, these rites are viewed with this kind of like interesting detachment. This stuff is maybe real, but it is not going to influence how I live my life because I'm respectable and I'm a professor and I wear suits and I drink my coffee in the morning because I'm a Jack Mormon. And then I go and teach my class and then I go back to my little apartment and read my books. I'm not going to like start putting on headdresses and stuff like that because that's all primitive. And even I think the knight at the end of the Last Crusade is really representative of this. It's all in the past. It's forgotten. It's interesting and maybe powerful, but I don't have to abide by it because I'm a respectable 20th century person.
Yeah, I have noticed because I personally love the things about Mormon culture that a lot of people find uncomfortable. I was teaching Sunday school and I had mentioned a list of rites I had written. I'm like, we have religious rites. And I just in passing, as I didn't think anything of it. And an older woman raised her hand and she was quite angry with me. We are not weird people who have weird rites like other. And I was quite taken aback because I find in Mormonism this interesting meeting place between what we might consider more Protestant, home-based, personal-based religion. But we still have these ceremonies and physical aspects of religion that we find very important. I was interested because when I was growing up, and I didn't think I was particularly special about this, I thought this was Mormon theology because Joseph Smith had said, the inquiry is frequently made of me, wherein do you differ from others in your religious views? In reality, in essence, we do not differ so far in our religious views, but that we would drink all into one principle of love. One of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is to receive truth, let it come from whence it may. My father had served a mission in Japan. I don't think he came away from that mission with a disdain for Japanese or Shinto beliefs or Buddhism. Instead, when he took us, and we lived there for several years, he would take us to the temples. He would say, look at all this beauty, look at this spiritual truth. And he would tell us explicitly that Mormonism was to look for those good truths in all the different religions. And I have a real fear that sometimes when we try to move away from that, because we're trying to relate more to maybe the religions around us currently, that we are losing something really special that's inherent to us. Like in Indiana Jones, it made sense to me that Indiana Jones would be so international, that he would go to India and that he would care about children. One of the patterns of Indiana Jones, it always seems to be the pattern until maybe the more recent movies, was that Indiana Jones would go when interested in something for an archaeological reason, have a lot of enthusiasm, and then unexpectedly, it would have some sort of real power that would save him from evil at the last minute.
That's the tension that Mormonism is dealing with in microcosm in the early 20th century, which is to say, we have a past in which people think we were quote unquote weird. We're trying to move on and become respectable and quote unquote normal, but we don't want to sever ourselves completely from that past. In all three of the first movies, right, the past is interesting and seductive and fascinating and powerful, but also a little bit alien. It's not the way we do things now. The Ark of the Covenant, the Kali Stones, the Holy Grail, right? These things are, and quite literally in the case of the Last Crusade, where the Holy Grail is tucked away in a place where it cannot lead. It is stored in this past, but we can go to it, to our normal, respectable lives.
It's interesting to hear Liz point out the sort of the cyclical nature of how some of these things were dealt with by Latter-day Saints in the early 20th century. I was just thinking, like, my wife and I went to the temple this morning, and the very high church ritual of the endowment ceremony is jarring for some Latter-day Saints. And I remember hearing Fiona Givens talk about how she thinks the best temple prep would be to send people to go to Mass so they see what, like, a group worship service is, right? And I had a friend of mine who was in my master's program at Yale who told me, like, oh, I love the temple. I love the Celestial Room. I don't know about the endowment. And I'm like, stop being such a New England Protestant. We still have these tensions in our church. It's interesting to be able to watch Indiana Jones deal with some of these same things because it's early 20th century, a little removed from us. You can put yourself in his shoes and say, like, well, what does it mean to believe very strongly in the truth claims of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but be able to go to Mass and to have a positive experience? Is that like what Indiana Jones, who's having these sort of otherworldly experiences, should he let it change him? It never seems to have, which is one of my disappointments about Dial of Destiny, actually. It's just like, oh, he's retiring from Hunter College, and this was his life, and it never amounted to anything more than that. And that gets to his arc in Dial of Destiny. Is this all Indiana Jones is? And that has some interesting implications for what is a life well lived, was the theme of the fifth movie, which I enjoyed.
Oh, I have two quick thoughts. First was talking about the Ark of the Covenant being filed away in these boxes, and that, to me, is the most Latter-day Saint thing that
we're going to go store this in the granite vault, guys. We'll get to it later.
We literally did it with the seer stone, and then they dragged it out and took a picture of it and put it in the ensign like 150 years later.
And the word that is so often used here, right, is weird. That stuff is weird. And of course, our definition for weird comes from a respectable Protestant culture. In kind of religious studies terms, Megan, we call that, right? That is the submersion of charisma into bureaucracy. And that's what happens in all of these movies, right? They go to this kind of charismatic weirdness. They find it, but then they retreat and go back to normalcy. Normalcy being regular Protestantism.
So interesting to see how people are trying to integrate that today. Like, I think of Anthony Sweat and other LDS artists who are trying to, like, provide these illustrations of these more weird aspects of LDS history. Doing illustrations of the seer stones and looking in the hat and of different anointings and washings that people did back in the day that we don't do nowadays, and the more Mormon literature and weird Mormon art movement that's just surging right now with people trying to say, no, wait, actually, we don't want to be Protestant. Let's be Mormon and let's bring all this weirdness back out of the closet and, like, accept it as part of us.
I'm just giving another plug for Angels and Seer Stones right now. That's a great podcast. You should all go listen to it because it brings some of that old school weirdness back. It talks about it in great and interesting ways.
And very positive ways. I love that.
In The Last Crusade, after he gets that Cross of Coronado back, the man doesn't have a name. They call him Panama Hat in the script. Panama Hat is talking to Indiana Jones as he's adult. And Indiana Jones says, it belongs in a museum. And then he says something very interesting back to Indiana Jones.
So do you.
So do you. And that tie feels like a really good tie to Dial of Destiny. Does he belong in a museum? The aesthetics of especially the early part of Dial of Destiny, the moon landing, the TVs, the more casual culture of dress and behavior of the characters. Can we bring that older approach? Does it feel too anachronistic in this modern world? Feels like kind of the conflict in Dial of Destiny that I related to. There's a part where Indiana Jones is talking to Helena, his goddaughter, and he says, why would you study the thing that made your father crazy? And she says, "Wouldn't you?" And in the theater, as I was watching it, my heart felt seen for a moment, because I spend so much of my time studying this cross between LDS culture and history. And I said, yeah, like, this is how I feel talking to people who say, this thing was such a conflict to your ancestors. This thing feels like a paradox. Why would you study it, this thing that's driving your ancestors crazy? Because I think it's worth it. I don't think it belongs in a museum. We need it now.
Notice, right, one thing that strikes me now about that exchange between the Panama Hat guy and Indiana Jones is Indiana Jones says the cross belongs in a museum, which is fascinating. Does the Holy Grail belong in a museum? Does the Ark of the Covenant belong in that big warehouse? Right, a museum is where you store something and you put it away and you make it safe and you defang it. And to say, right, that about the past, I think shows Jones's, as a character, right, this really complicated draw that he has towards the weirdness and the strangeness and the interestingness of the past, but also his desire to contain it, to keep it safe, to leave it somewhere where it's not going to actually change people, right? And or destroy whole armies, like the Ark of the Covenant might be, right? The American army could have used the Ark of the Covenant, but they don't, right? They instead put it away and make it safe. History always changes, and what becomes weird and strange and the thing that needs to be put in a museum changes over time. And where he is grappling with that in the first three movies, he is the one who is being grappled with in the last few movies as the thing that maybe needs to be put in a museum.
It just reminds me of an exchange I had with a friend of mine who was an art historian visiting a monastery in the Sinai Peninsula, at the place where at least they think this is the actual Mount Sinai. And there's this gorgeous mosaic there. And he's looking at this mosaic going, ah, I want to cut this out of the wall and go put it somewhere where it's climate controlled and contained so the art can last forever. And then part of my response was like, but don't take the art out of the monastery. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
That's where it belongs in context. It's interesting to see him wrestle with that tension as an art historian, but also as a religious believer.
And that's great, right? That disjuncture between the academic and the believer, right? Do we think, right, boy, like if we found the Ark of the Covenant, would contemporary Jewish people and Christians want it stored in a warehouse? Would they want it in a museum? No, it is contemporary Protestants, right? I'm being a little bit flip with that, but I think it's true, right? People who understand religion to be about personal ethics, about being a nice person, about fitting into society, avoiding that kind of disruptive weirdness that all of these things provide. They're the ones who would say, no, leave it where it is. Like, leave it, let the Ark of the Covenant be out in the world where it's supposed to be, not in a box, in a warehouse somewhere. One of the stories, I think, in the Indiana Jones movies is how the contemporary world defangs all of these religions, right? And makes them into something that's safe, put away in a museum, not active, disrupting the world.
Well, that's the thing I want to talk a little bit about is the fourth movie, which is so weird because suddenly there are transdimensional aliens as part of all of this. And when you put all five of the movies together, it seems like there just happens to be a lot of weird stuff in the universe, right? It's all very Shakespearean, more things dreamt of in heaven and hell than dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio, including aliens from the world between worlds or whatever he says at the end of the movie, right? And so it's not that God exists and had some covenant with the Jewish people. It's just that they happened to find an artifact that would melt their enemies' armies. And it's not that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He happened upon an artifact that makes people immortal. It's not that The crystal skulls actually imbue you with some kind of religious significance. They just happen to be the skulls of extraterrestrial beings that are really smart. It's not that right? So you just have this really weird, bizarre world as a whole that now you have to try to make sense of. And it's interesting, Matt, you bring up, I would say there is a difference between putting Coronado's cross in the museum where people could visit and look at it and putting the Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail, like, safely tucked away where nobody's ever going to see it again. That to me feels like there's a difference between those two as well. But this question of how do we make sense of the world when there are all these varying contradictory question mark things going on, I think actually the fourth and fifth movies take away from the power of the original trilogy, because the middle movie was just, okay, that was a little weird, because I'm the theologian here, right? About how real is all this stuff? Where does it come from? Who's powering that arc? Like, where does it get its ability to melt Nazis' faces off? Suddenly, when you have two sort of monotheistic things coupled with three non-monotheistic things, now that we have the five movies, it reduces the questions and the power that we've been talking about that I think are mostly dealt with in the first three movies. And then the last two movies end up being more of a commentary on Indiana Jones, the character, rather than the world itself.
Yeah, and I think they make it explicit in the fifth movie where you've got this fake, the opening ending of the adventure is this fake Christian artifact, the Spear of Longinus that was used to pierce Christ. And that turns out to be a fake, which, and then we proceed to go on to something from ancient Greek and it's science-based. I think there's definitely some symbolism in that transition there.
And this question about science, right? And what is science? And of course, after World War II, there's so much grappling in American culture with the relationship between religion and science, especially after the atomic bomb, right? And after the discovery of genetics. There is a famous book called Chariots of the Gods that is written by this Swiss hotel manager named Eric von Däniken. Von Däniken says all religious traditions are basically the same. They're all doing the same thing. They're all telling the same thing. But von Däniken says they're all the same because everybody who human beings have thought were deities or angels or gods were in fact aliens. And the idea here, I think, is nutty and a little bit racist, right? Because von Däniken is saying the Egyptians could not have built the pyramids. It had to have been aliens because they were primitives. But he is also making this argument that religion and science are basically the same thing. There is no sort of supernatural world and natural world. There's only this universe. This is the famous Arthur C. Clarke line that all sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. That's what Däniken is saying about religion. All religion is really just technology we don't understand.
And I really like the way Captain Pike in Star Trek Discovery in one of its episodes talked about, reworked that to say any sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial intelligence would be indistinguishable from God.
I think actually what's interesting, right, is that this fourth movie does in fact weirdly fit into the way that these Indiana Jones movies have been treating religion all along, which is to say, right, there's all of these different powers out in the world. And this is this basic kind of liberal Protestant message of early 20th century is that all religions are basically the same. They all do basically the same thing. They all can grant human beings power and salvation and so on and so forth. To use a word I used before, they're all pluralist. All the movies reject exclusive monotheism. They say there's multiple powers, there's multiple weird things in the world, and we're just grappling with them. And the fourth movie, I think, really adopts and adapts this kind of mid-20th century fascination with UFOs to make that same argument, just adapted and updated to include technology as a religion.
There is a problem with having an artifact that you can study. There's a historian named Lily Filson who talks about how in medieval and Renaissance churches, they often had early automatons, so the saints would appear to move, or the statue might bleed or weep, or even the crucifixes were hinged, and that as part of the Reformation, when they took them down, they would open them up in the city square to show the gear works to the people. That there's a problem with having a physical thing sometimes, but I think that we understand a little bit closer to the way Indiana Jones's dad understands it. That famous scene where he slaps Indiana Jones, he says, that's blasphemy, and he gives this speech that goes, the quest for the Grail is not archaeology. It's a race against evil. If it is captured by the Nazis, the armies of darkness will march all over the face of the earth, which is a very almost Templar LDS understanding of evil.
Feels very Dan Brown.
Exactly. But also, I think it's funny. I'm going to try to be very careful with how I express this, that we explicitly say in our high rites and religions that Satan has a global destructive view. He wants militaries and riches in order to oppress others. But we are one of the few religions who explicitly state he's part of the armies of darkness that march over the face of the earth to oppress others. But returning to what I said, The quest for the Grail is not archaeology, at least not in Indiana Jones's father's mind. And I'm imagining Indiana Jones's father as part of that later pioneer influx coming into the Utah Valley, that they would have an understanding that the literal is not the symbolic. We don't have transubstantiation in our sacrament. You don't need any special effects. You don't need CGI to show a Mormon spiritual expression.
That also, I think, goes to the point I was making earlier about film four, right? Which is, what is the difference between religion and science? Are these coherent categories or not? And there have been a lot of LDS theologians, and particularly in the early 20th century, right, who argued that religion and science were essentially the same thing, that it did not make sense to think of these categories as somewhat something different, that in fact God was God because he had mastered physical laws of the universe, and he wasn't doing miracles just by like snapping his fingers, right, that he built and constructed and used what we would understand as scientific methods.
Back to the Arthur C. Clarke quote, I remember like in Superman Returns, Lex Luthor says it, and then I encountered it in Star Trek Discovery, and then the Arthur C. Clarke, and I remember reading Jesus the Christ, where James Talmadge makes the same point, and I'm like, well, there's our out of the mouth of two or three witnesses. We got Arthur Clarke and James Talmadge and Lex Luthor, and now Captain Pike all just start describing the same thing, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Okay, I found it fascinating, the comment you made, Megan, in our show notes about the central MacGuffin that they're looking for in this latest movie, the Dial of Destiny, being, oh, a dial of curious workmanship from the ancient world. Where have we heard of this thing before?
So perhaps it points the way wherever in time you should go. Whenever I see gear-based metal technology in the ancient world, It totally reflects. I'm like, well, that's very Mormon of them to have thought of it. Like the alethiometer in the Philip Pullman books. Whole time I'm like, well, that makes perfect sense to me that God would be willing to work with a physical mechanism. It bothers me a little that they call it Antikythera, because the Antikythera is the island where they found it. And like, it should just be called the mechanism. But when I saw it, to understand that the ancient world might have kind of a mechanism like that, this was a fun thing for me just because of my Latter-day Saint background.
I did want to hit a little bit on the theme that I actually liked about the fifth movie, even though I thought it had a lot of other issues. And I'm not sure as a whole, now with all five, I like Indiana Jones as much as when it was just three and then four. Like, it gets a little bit less every time they cram something else into it, in my estimation. But the idea that he is taken back to the place where he feels he most belongs, like ancient Rome, there's this battle, he gets to meet Archimedes in person, like there's all this cool stuff. He's like, I want to stay here. And his goddaughter basically has to like give out to Archimedes and say, this is a great man, but he belongs in his own time. And then he goes back, and it turns out, I think that's the point where we realize that Mutt, his son, who we're only introduced in the fourth movie, has died in Vietnam, but he has to go back to Marion. This idea of, you've studied this, you've made this your whole life, but it turns out that's not what's actually important. Like the theme of another movie I really like, Interstellar, where it's like, I've seen the vastness of the universe, I just want to get home to my daughter, is a theme. I've seen the vastness of history and time, and I could actually go there now, but really I should just go back home to be with my wife in our grief over our son. Which I think is a really interesting theme about what is actually important, even if it took us five movies to get there. It doesn't seem like they were deliberately leading up to that at all. It's not necessarily foreshadowed, but at the same time, I felt it was a good moral sort of to end on.
You know what the very first line he says in The Dial of Destiny is? He says, I like to be alone. And that's where he starts. And then by the end of the movie, he is with his wife, he's back with his family and Helena, and he's not alone anymore. Like, he could have left, but maybe he didn't always want to be alone. I personally think it's irresponsible to have a time machine and not use it to go back in time and save Antonio Banderas. That seems like a sin.
And just as a nerd point, I love that the bad guy in Dial of Destiny, like, there's the science fiction trope, right? Oh, what's the first thing you do when you invent the time machine? You go back and kill Hitler. He's like,
no, he's going to go back and kill Hitler and replace him and do his job better. It's like, oh, good.
I thought that was one of the few, like, really clever things where I said, no, they're going to go back in time and the bad guys are going to kill Hitler. It's such an excellent twist on the trope.
Going back to the family thing, I think you could tie it back to his reconciliation with his dad in the third movie. So, like, his dad was always gone adventuring, and eventually they reconcile. They have different points of view about the purpose of archaeology and belief in artifacts. And then he goes through the same thing with Helena in this film, right? Like, she's like, get the artifacts, sell them for money. Let's do an auction. Like, she's not even going for a museum. She's going straight black market. Like, which rich Saudi prince can I sell this to? No moral qualms about that at all. And so Indy's museum qualms are like a little, that's a good middle ground compared to where she was going. But like, then she makes the same accusations to him. You were never there. And so in a way, that's like him fixing the mistakes that his father made with him, like trying to repair this cycle that's going on.
And very contemporary, right? The purpose of everything is personal fulfillment with your family. So much for saving or transforming the course of civilization.
All right, well, let's move on to our ratings segment then. This is mostly going to be about Dial of Destiny, but I don't know if you want to talk generally about the Indiana Jones saga, all five of them now, feel free to do so. So our first rating is on content, clean versus objectionable material, and we rate it according to the Latter-day Saint Afterlife, Celestial, Terrestrial, Telestial, and Outer Darkness. Where would you put this movie? We'll start with you, Liz. Where do you rate this one?
So I was getting ready to watch the fifth movie for this podcast, and I was talking to my husband. I was like, oh, we should watch these with the kids. And he's like, do you remember the massive amounts of like gore and violence that go on and like pulling people's hearts out of their chest? So you probably know from the original three films, there were some moments of violence that I was like, whoa, I'm so used to superhero, very clean violence. That I was like, oh, like we're actually going to stab through things and like see that happen. So maybe a little more violence than I would watch with like young kids. So I'm going to put it with like Terrestrial, just for the violence aspect. It was a little bit shocking compared to superhero movies. If you're used to superhero violence, it's much less clean.
Megan, what do you think? How would you rate this one on our Latter-day Saint Afterlife scale of objectionable content?
Huh. I think that you're right. I think it's Terrestrial. I think that even in early films, it almost seems more cartoonish, but there's quite a bit of blood. They kill a lot of people with no resolution. Didn't have to kill the FBI agent that way. I don't think that was necessary for the plot. Who dares kill Antonio Banderas? I'll make it Telestial just for that. That's a crime.
Matt, how about you?
Terrestrial for the flagrant looting of ancient civilizations.
Yes, you get to talk about the nature of the British Museum with your kids after this film.
I think I would put it at a high Telestial, a low Terrestrial myself. And I think that would be true of the overall five movies as well. Like, doesn't the guy get chopped up by an airplane propeller in the first movie? And let's remember that Raiders of the Lost Ark was the movie that they created the PG-13 rating for, literally. Because they're like, this isn't really R, it's PG. And Spielberg is like, I'm not going to take my kids to go see this. What are you talking about? That's when they made PG-13 as a rating. So that's parental guidance for kids under 13. I think that seems about right. And our next rating, artistic merit, skillful, effective use of craft. Our rating is 1 to 5 popcorn balls. We'll start with you this time, Matt. Dial of Destiny in particular, but anything you want to comment on the rest of Indiana Jones as well?
And I will actually even say this about Temple of Doom. I think the first three are stone cold masterpieces. 5, I think maybe because I had that VHS tape for my youth, I actually like the third the best. That one is a 5. I think both Crystal Skull and Dial of Destiny, I think, are worthy efforts, but aren't quite there. Frankly, I think they're both just a little bit too long. They need to be better. So I think for the last two, I would say 3 or 4.
It's interesting to do one of those things where you try to rank them, like which ones do you think are the best? And for me, I think it would be Last Crusade and then Raiders of the Lost Ark and then Dial of Destiny. And then the infamous survive a nuclear explosion in a fridge scene just kind of ruins a whole bunch of Crystal Skull for me. So I think I'm going to have to go Crystal Skull is at the very bottom. Just because it's terrible. And so 4 then is Temple of Doom. So I think overall, I'm going to give the whole thing a 4 because these are just classic movies. I think I agree with Matt that the first three are stone cold awesome, just classics. The last two, not as good. I think Dial of Destiny itself, I would give 4 popcorn balls to. It's a fair movie. It hits a lot of the same sorts of things, just with Harrison Ford being in his 60s now. Overall, I give the whole thing a 4. I give Dial of Destiny a 4. Crystal Skull gets a 1. I did not like Crystal Skull hardly at all. I'm sorry. Megan, we'll have you go next. Artistic Merrick, 1 to 5 popcorn balls.
Wow, 4 popcorn balls seems very generous for Dial of Destiny. I think it might be a high 2. I'll give it a 3 out of Christian charity, just because I feel like there's actually a really good Indiana Jones movie in it. I just can't see it. I didn't feel emotionally involved as much as I do in other Indiana Jones films. And I went in the best of circumstances with the whole crowd full of like crazed Indiana Jones fans when I saw it. And everyone still went, wow, and left. So I think 3, 2 popcorn balls.
Liz, how about you?
So Megan really covered the end. I wanted to talk about the beginning of the film because I heard Brandon Sanderson give a talk on kind of the Indiana Jones format where you start in medias res of the previous adventure and you finish it and usually he fails, and how that sets up the tension because Indiana Jones isn't perfect. He doesn't end up winning that one. And so we know that he's imperfect as he goes into this other one. And the way that you can do all of the exposition part of the movie while you're wrapping up that previous adventure, I just love that genre convention that they've got going. And I think this movie nailed that beginning part. I really like the Nazis on a train and the blowing up of things and going through the floor with the unexploded bomb, and I thought the beginning was really epic. So I'm going to give it 4 just for nailing the Indiana Jones opening and like being a good example of like this revival of kind of an older action movie style.
And our final rating is Gospel Connections 1 to 5 apricots, morally edifying messages. Megan, we'll have you start this time. What's your thought on Dial of Destiny again specifically, but maybe Indiana Jones as a whole?
I think Dial of Destiny, I'm going to give it 4 apricots because I think that the overall message was love of family and kind of a kindness for elders was a part of the plot, that watching Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones struggle through around the younger people, struggle to fit in the new society. I'll give it 4 apricots for showing us some moral lessons. Overall, Indiana Jones as a whole is definitely 5 apricots, especially the first 3 movies, but we all can't be perfect, which is also an important moral lesson. Sometimes you're a crystal skull.
Oh, Liz, we'll have you go next. Gospel Connections, 1 to 5 apricots.
I mean, for the LDS connection, I would like having that discussion is awesome. I would give that 4 apricots. The early, I'm going to go with 4 apricots overall, like talking about the connection between like belief and doubt and science and theology and all these fun LDS connections that you can blow your kids' minds with.
I said, we all remember that famous conversation he has with his dad where he says, the last time we had a relaxing drink together, I had a milkshake. You got to have a milkshake with your kids before you watch Indiana Jones. But it's a very LDS, it fit well within my headcanon. Nothing in them can't fit in my headcanon.
5 apricots for the milkshake, definitely. Yeah, no, I think generally what we have learned from all 5 movies is that Indiana Jones exists in an LDS cosmology. So 5 all the way.
All right. That means I'm going to be the negative Nancy.
Do it.
So Dial of Destiny, I'm going to give 4 to. And Liz knows, and the listeners of the podcast will know, I don't want to give something 5 unless there's like an explicitly like a Jesus gospel connection sort of thing, right? Like I just reserve 5s for that. But there were some good themes about maybe it was not the friends we met along the way, but the family we made along the way, right? Like that's the real treasure. And just the interaction between him and his goddaughter and her motivation and him wrestling with his motivation and trying to help her be a better person and not realize it's not all about just selling it to black market Saudi Arabian princes or whatever. The concept of destiny itself, and if you could go back and change things, how would you, is always one that's just fun. They didn't really hit on that too much, but it's there. It's in the background. Where do you belong? Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also, I feel like, is a relevant theme of this movie. So I'm going to give this one 4 overall. I'm going to do a little weird thing with Indiana Jones here with the overall rating. I'm going to give it two apricots, unless you just listen to our really interesting discussion about the difference between religion and science and theology and culture and Latter-day Saints in the early 20th century. If you have that sort of thing in mind, you can get a lot out of this, and I'll bump the whole thing up to four. But since I didn't until about 90 minutes ago, I would have given it two before then because it's just pulp fiction and I don't know what to make of the realities behind all these powers. And it's just weird and fun, but didn't seem like really gospel connection, especially now that we've got two gospel connected artifacts and three that are not. And it's just like, oh, it like dilutes the importance of those gospel artifacts for me. But I don't know, y'all have convinced me it's a Indiana Jones exists in a Mormon cosmology. So here we are.
Okay, question, Carl. Question, would you have given the original trilogy a higher rating, just those three?
Yes, because then you're looking at Temple of Doom as this weird outlier among the other two. You're like, okay. And Temple of Doom is great. Pulp Fiction, I love the point where Indiana Jones punches the guy in the mine and he flies through, hits the ground, and skids like 20 feet. I'm like, yep, this is absolutely Pulp Fiction because nobody can punch someone that hard, but Harrison Ford can because of reasons, right? But having two of the artifacts be the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail makes it more monotheistic in general. And then you can treat the Kali Stones as the outlier, and it feels more religious to me.
I don't think they are an outlier. I think stones with mystical powers are very Mormon.
I can recognize I'm the outlier on this one.
Well, I hope the studios hear that listening to our podcast makes the Indiana Jones experience much richer. They should recommend it to all their viewers.
When I show it to my kids, I kind of want to start with the opening of Last Crusade and show that to them and be like, Indiana Jones is a Jack Mormon. And then we can go back to the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark and start from there and see how that changes how they view the rest of the movie.
Last thought, there's the scene where Indiana Jones, he has this tool. And like Liz was saying, his tools often fail. That's like a big Indiana Jones thing. His tools will fail him. He looks down, his gun has no bullets and an airplane is heading right for them. And his father looked at the seagulls. And in that moment, you see it cross his face. And I like to imagine that he was thinking of the miracle of the gulls. And the gulls, and then he chases the seagulls and the seagulls wipe out the airplane. And I was like, as a young adult, I was like, well, that makes perfect sense. He would remember. It would be very important that seagulls would be a helper to save the Holy Grail.
Thanks for joining us this episode of Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree. You can follow me on Threads. I'm at Carl Cranny. Liz, where can people find you?
You can follow my writing and book reviews at lizbusby.com, or I'm also mirroring it now on Substack. So lizbusby.substack.com. You can find me there too.
Megan, any social media or anything you'd like to plug?
No, because of my husband's job, I can't recommend things or have much of a social media presence. But I can do this. That's fine.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to have you on board. Matt, anything you want to plug? You want to please plug your book?
Yeah, I am one of those who has come to believe that social media is evil. Oh, really, since 2015 or so. So I avoid social media, although I'm around it a little bit because I have to use it sometimes for my job and to push my work on aliens. I just published a book on alien abduction in the United States. You can learn a lot more about Eric von Däniken in that book. It is called The Abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. I am currently working on a book about UFO belief in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from the 1830s to the present. We are starting with Quakers on the Moon. And we are going to be ending with near-death experiences in Jubilee Row and people like that.
One to look forward to. All right. Thanks for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, share the podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice or on YouTube. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode via email, social media, or on our website. It really makes our day as podcast hosts to hear from you. Liz, can you tell us what we will be discussing in our next episode?
All right. Well, we are going to be discussing the many iterations of Pride and Prejudice. This is our Valentine's Day theme. We wanted to do a love story. So we're going to just look at a bunch of different Pride and Prejudice adaptations, talking about why this story sticks around and gets picked up, like we did with our Christmas Carol episode. So watch your favorite Pride and Prejudice adaptation for Valentine's Day with your friends or partners, and then come back and send us your thoughts about that. And we're going to be talking about that on our next episode.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so fun.
I look forward to watching Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It still fits. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.